following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the origins of innovation. That's been a theme that has long interested popular science writer Stephen Johnson. An innovator himself, Johnson has helped create three influential websites: the online magazine pioneer Feed.com, the community site Plastic.com, and his latest venture, the hyperlocal site Outside.in. Johnson is a contributing writer at Wired Magazine and contributes to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal as well. And he's the author of 8 books on topics ranging from brain neuroscience to historical epidemiology to inventors of the 18th century. His most recent book has focused on how discoveries and innovations take place. His book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation, is now out in softcover. And he's just edited a collection of essays on a wide group of thinkers in the innovation process titled The Innovator's Cookbook. It features essays by management guru Peter Drucker, urban theorist Richard Florida, Jeff Mulgan, the head of the National Endowment for Science, Technology, and the Arts, musician and composer Brian Eno, and open government advocate Beth Novak, just to name a few. The collection is a wide-ranging look at the ideas and actions that foster creativity and lead to change, highlighting the innovation and innovative thinkers in a number of fields, from science, technology, to energy, transportation, education, and art. Stephen Johnson is my guest today. Stephen Johnson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be back.
You know, this new book, The Innovator's Cookbook, this seems to be a time of massive innovation. It's hard to think of a time when life over, say, the last 30 years has changed as much as today, maybe the turn of the 20th century. So it seems like if this is a time of major innovation, why the intense study? Seems like we're doing fine.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. I agree with you. But, you know, the truth is there are a lot of folks who've started to make this argument that, in fact, innovation is slowing down. And in part, it depends on how you measure it. You know, if you measure it actually in terms of, you know, kind of pure speed or kind of energy processing, it has slowed down. You know, we had, you know, tremendous explosion, literal explosion in our ability to kind of process energy that we had with the Industrial Revolution and the invention of nuclear power and things like that. And then, of course, you know, the speed with which we could travel went from horses to, you know, railroads to jet planes, but then that kind of stopped, basically. And in fact, we've gone backwards a little bit in terms of speed ever since they retired the Concorde.
That's true.
And so some people look around and say, well, you know, actually, we're not making as much progress. But what has changed, of course, and I think this is what, one of the things you're thinking about, is the speed of information moving around the world, and the things that we now can do with digital technology has been just, you know, the last 20 years has been extraordinary. And so there are folks out there who are concerned, and then there's this inevitable concern that people have seemingly had forever, which is that the United States in particular is somehow losing its innovation edge, although I think there's actually very little evidence to suggest that. But whether you think, you know, there's concern about it or whether you just want to see more of it, the question, you know, it's still important. And we want to build kind of tools and systems that allow us as individuals and as a country and as organizations to be more innovative in our thinking.
I was really struck by something you wrote about in your introduction, which was, you know, not all of our things we consider innovation has been true innovation. And a lot of the financial innovations that has fueled the economy over the last 20 to 30 years has turned out to be illusory.
And, right. Yeah. The financial sector is one of those places where there is such a thing as too much innovation. You know, I think we probably had a little too much. I mean, there is some, you look at an innovation like the creation of a venture capital, like that's, I think that has clearly been a force for good. And it's generated enormous amounts of wealth for the venture capitalists themselves, who are very much part of the 1%, to use the Occupy Wall Street terminology. But it's money that, and it's a system that developed to support new ideas, to support innovative companies and startups. And in fact, one of its great properties is that it's a kind of an economic model that is dependent on or at least makes room for failure and error, right? And the whole idea of being a venture capitalist is that you invest in a lot of these risky companies, and 80% of the time they fail, and they make no money for you, lose your money. But, you know, it's that 20% that do turn out to make a ton of money, and that covers your losses for the other ones. And so when you have that system where there's an opportunity for people to take risks, that's what really kind of drives new ideas and new industries or businesses. And so that's a great financial innovation. But when we talk about just, you know, kind of elaborate derivative schemes and kind of just pure speculation, I think a lot of that stuff is less helpful.
Yeah, it seems like there's been a lot of emphasis on finding the middle, as the gamblers would say.
Right. <Yeah. laughs>
Where it doesn't matter whether things go good or bad, you still make money. And what's interesting is, I think getting back to this concern about innovation, is we've had two or three generations where not all of the brightest minds, but many of the brightest minds, immediately turn to Wall Street. Because, you know, starting salaries, I think the last I heard was like somewhere around $350,000 a year. Yeah. And they went to Wall Street rather than Detroit or Silicon Valley or the Research Triangle in North Carolina or the Austin area or any sort of research universities and the like. Is this something we should be concerned about?
I do think it is something we should be concerned about. It's, you know, there's a wonderful new movie that just came out called Margin Call that's just starting to hit theaters around, and it's basically a kind of a fictionalized story of Lehman Brothers and their collapse. And there's a character in it who's kind of a young kid who's 27 or 28, and he kind of partially figures out why the firm is going to collapse. He's kind of brilliant math and engineering whiz, and they're having a meeting with his boss at some point, and they say, you know, so wait, what's your deal, kid? You know, what's your background? And he says, well, I was doing jet propulsion systems, you know, graduated from MIT and was working in jet propulsion. And they say, wait, so you're an actual rocket scientist? and he's like, yes. And he's like, so why are you here? And he's like, the money is so much better working at a Wall Street firm than building rockets, you know. And, you know, those are the minds that, you know, could be creating those next generation jet engines that could actually take us past the Concorde, and instead they're going and doing complex, you know, credit default swaps that end up actually being, as Warren Buffett, you know, has called that kind of derivative speculation, you know, weapons of financial mass destruction. So we want to encourage people to come up with new ideas and innovate and reward them financially when they do. That's the beauty of the marketplace. But we want them to actually be kind of building real things.
And that is sort of the point of your essay, is there's a growing group of people says we need to start making useful things rather than, say, financial sleight of hand.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the other thing that's important that I tried to get across in that essay, and indeed in a lot of the conversations and essays that are in the book, and this came out very much out of Where Good Ideas Come From, which we talked about last year when it came out, my last book, is that encouraging that kind of innovation is not just up to the market. It's actually something that we do in the public sector as well, and that the government, which we make fun of and deride as being, you know, kind of ineffectual bureaucracies all the time. Actually, the government plays an important role in innovation and has. You know, you think about a company like Google, it had a tremendous financial success, you know, made billions of dollars for its shareholders and its employees. But Google is impossible, doesn't exist without the Internet and doesn't exist without the World Wide Web. And both the Internet and the World Wide Web were created outside of the private sector. They were created either by government institutions, by the military, or by kind of academic researchers who were not, who really didn't make a dime out of it. Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web, you know, he didn't commercialize it. He didn't turn it into a private company. And that's precisely what made it so powerful and enabled it to become this platform that then Google and many, many other companies could turn into great commercial businesses. But it was a mix. It was a mix of that kind of private sector innovation and kind of non-market innovation that made it so powerful.
It's interesting, the two examples you use in your essay of sort of what you see as maybe some of the interesting side effects of new innovation. is Kickstarter and C-Click-Fix. And you were talking earlier about venture capital. And now here's a very democratic model with Kickstarter. For people who don't know Kickstarter, Kickstarter is basically a way for somebody who has a great idea to get capital. Sometimes it's at the level of $25 or $50 or $100 to, you know, thousands to get an idea started. And C-Click-Fix is, again, getting back to this government sort of thing. It's people seeing a problem. They click to let this website know, and then government fixes the problem. Really innovative. Go ahead.
They're kind of hybrid systems. Kickstarter, I think, is one of the most interesting things to happen in the web space in the last couple of years. It's specifically designed to support creative artists, really, people who are somebody's trying to finish their film, somebody's trying to finish their album, somebody's trying to finish their art installation, and they need $10,000 to finish it, or they need $50,000 to finish it. And in the old days, what you would do is you would either go to a big government institution like the National Endowment for the Arts or something like that and try and get a grant, or you would find a wealthy patron who could afford to give you $50,000 for the love of your kind of creative endeavor, or you would just save up the money or max out your credit cards or whatever.
Or you would sell your rights.
Give up control of your stuff. And the truth is, with a lot of experimental art, there may not be an economic market for it, you know, but that doesn't mean, at least initially, you know, cutting edge art often, you know, finds a market 10 years later. It's hard, you know, that's what makes it challenging, is if it's outside our normal kind of taste or boundaries, but it's still important for society to do that kind of creative work. So what Kickstarter says is, and this is just a beautiful idea, is the world is filled with people who would like to be patrons of the arts, but they don't have a spare $50,000 sitting around, but they do have a spare $50 sitting around, or they do have a spare $200 sitting around. And if you could aggregate and pool all those people together, you could actually support, you know, kind of richer, more complex, more expensive works by, in a sense, what we would now call kind of crowdfunding a project. And so Kickstarter lets you go online and you say, listen, I'm trying to finish this series of paintings. I need $10,000 to do it. If you support me, I will invite you to the opening party at the gallery, or I will send you a lithograph of one of the, you know, whatever it is. You can offer any kind of reward you want, or no reward if you don't want. And the one key thing they figured out is if you pledge money, your pledge does not get processed. The money doesn't get kind of transferred to the artist until they have met their overall goal. So you're not caught, you know, giving $50 to the artist who never raises enough money to finish their project, so they just take your money and spend it drinking beer, right? You know? So, you know, your money is held in escrow, in a sense, until the artist reaches their $10,000 goal or $50,000 goal, whatever it is. And this thing works. I mean, it is amazing how much they funded. They just announced the other day, actually, this didn't even make the book. They are on track to distribute $100 million in 1 year to artists. And this company is just 2 years old, right? And the entire budget of the National Endowment for the Arts is $150 million. So this thing has gotten to be competitive in size and will clearly exceed it, I mean, given its track record, probably next year. It's as big and kind of influential as a massive institution like the National Endowment for the Arts. So, and the other thing about it, sorry, I could talk about Kickstarter all day, is it itself is a for-profit company. It has venture capital investors, and, you know, it's going to see a great return for its shareholders and its employees and its founders, I suspect. But what it makes possible is this interesting kind of non-market exchange between people who are just basically giving money away because they want to support artists that they like and feel like they're contributing something to the creative world.
My guest today is Stephen Johnson, best-selling author and internet pioneer. His latest book is titled The Innovator's Cookbook. It's an edited collection that sort of follows up on his most recent book, Where Good Ideas Come From, which is now out in softcover, too. And this is a softcover original, talking about innovation and where good ideas come from. Well, let's talk a little bit about the collection. You have some really great contributors. Peter Drucker addresses the types of innovation out there. I want to talk about one of the essays, which was kind of interesting take. It was Stuart Brand.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how old buildings spark creativity, in particular, building 20 at MIT tells the story of this. warehouse building that sort of spawned the birth of radar and lots of innovations since then. And it's about the idea that it's like this space that you can create within it because nobody cares about it because it's just this old, ugly building.
You know, it's one of my favorite essays in the book. And, in fact, I talked about it a little bit and where good ideas come from. And I just love that essay, and so I wanted to include it in this collection. It's from, actually, a book called How Buildings Learn that Stuart wrote, I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago, which is one of my favorite books of all time. But he basically talked about how this building at MIT they had built as a temporary structure in the early years of World War II, because they had all this work that they had to do, and they were scaling up to support the war. And so they just threw up this building, you know, it wasn't designed, it's about the ugliest building you could imagine, no architectural pedigree whatsoever. And they kind of threw it together, and it was designed to be torn down. It was a true temporary structure. It was designed to be torn down in 5 years, and it ended up lasting 50 years. And it was just this kind of beloved building, and it generated all, it basically out-innovated all the other buildings on the campus. So they kept, you know, no one would allow them to tear it down. And as you said, Stuart's kind of point is that it was such a flexible, adaptable space precisely because there was nothing, you know, kind of precious about it. It was, you know, you could just, if your team got onto an interesting project and doubled in size, you could just tear down a wall and you didn't have to call anybody and ask about it. Or you could drill a hole in the ceiling if you needed to attach something there to work on some new elaborate contraption you were working on. And so in a sense, the building was adaptable enough that it could kind of shift in response to the kind of the new ideas that were forming inside of it. And it's a great principle for how to design innovative spaces, but it's also kind of a nice metaphor to just kind of make your life that flexible and responsive to kind of the new paths, the new ideas that you kind of stumble across. There's a great, one of my favorite quotes from Jane Jacobs in her classic book about great American cities, where she has this line where she says, new ideas need old buildings. And if you look at the history of cities, so many kind of new movements, creative movements, artistic movements, new businesses start in kind of abandoned old spaces, old lofts, garages. You know, the old ideas move into the big fancy office buildings that are brand new, but the new ideas come in these kind of older fossils. And that's just a beautiful principle.
Yeah. Speaking of Jane Jacobs, you have a piece by Richard Florida on, you know, his creative class and how a creative place attract creative types. But I want to also talk about John Seely Brown and John Hagel's, which sort of targets innovation in an area where Western companies mostly ignore it. It gets back to our conversation earlier about, you know, innovation coming through $50 here and there through Kickstarter. And that's the idea that the emerging world and the low-income customers, you see a few companies, but really China is jumping on this really big, about marketing to them and adapting your products and innovating your products to serve people that you normally wouldn't serve. It's sort of the Walmart approach for American companies to, instead of going just after the affluent markets, going for the mass market in a lot of these
areas. Yeah, I think we have this kind of assumption that we think of the developing world or you know, whatever you would call China, which is clearly kind of beyond developing now. developed right ahead of us, in fact. We think of them as actually, you know, kind of a potential or an actual labor force. You know, you think about it as kind of cheap labor, but clearly if this is, you know, it's in our long-term interest here in the States to also think about them as potential customers. But you know, to be able to do that, you have to think about making things that are, you know, it's not just that they're going to make our iPhones for us, although it seems like that's what they're going to do, but they also should be buying something from us as well, or otherwise we're going to have this terrible, even worse trade imbalance. So to do that, you got to make different kinds of products, and you got to be attentive to that kind of market and what they're interested in and what they can afford.
They use the Cummins engine company, which, you know, they sell big giant engines all over the world, and they use the case study of India, where they were selling big engines, but they all of a sudden decided let's build small engines and compete with these little companies that build engines in India. And they found that the quality of their name, they're known for big engines, people flocked to an affordable small engine. And they end up having 40-50% of the market on that in India, a 1.1 billion person economy.
Right. Yep. If you sell a ton of very small, cheap things, it's just as good as selling a lot less of big, expensive things.
Another interesting essay, Harvard Business Professor Stefan Tomke and MIT Professor Eric von Hippel. This gets back to the C-click-fix, which we didn't talk about earlier. This idea of a company's customers become its innovators. This is a really interesting story about and interesting examples of where the company's customers basically help create the next generation of that company's products.
Yeah, it's a great principle. And that's, you know, that's von Hippel, particularly his work here has been really important. This concept of end user innovation. So normally the old way of doing it would be you would have, you know, your kind of research and development lab where, you know, the folks, you know, would sit there in their little, you know, Willy Wonka factory and come up with magical new products or, you know, create the vision of kind of new ideas. And what Tomke and von Hippel have argued is that, well, actually, you know, that's fine, but, you know, the folks who are really interesting are the folks who are already using your existing products and who really like them and who really invest with them. And it turns out people just on their own are constantly, like, tinkering and rejiggering and using kind of products in new ways. And those folks are just an amazing kind of resource for the company, in part because they're not, you don't have to pay them. they love it. You know, they love to give feedback to the company because, you know, if they've taken your product and push it in a new direction and the company learns from that and actually enhances the product so it makes it do that new use better, well, everybody wins, right? You get the new idea for free and the customer gets an even better tool. And we've seen this in the high-tech world a lot. This is one of the things that happened to Twitter. You know, Twitter was designed by its creators to really just be a kind of a way of sharing your status with your friends, basically, like, I'm having breakfast now, or, hey, let's meet up later on at this bar. And when it came out, people started to do all these different things with it. And one of the things they started to do is they started to use hashtags, where, you know, you'd say, you know, the little hash symbol, and then you would say, State of the Union. And if you were making comments about the State of the Union address, you would just make your comment and then you'd add the hashtag and then you could kind of follow all the hashtags to see what people were saying with a live event. Anytime you go to a tech conference nowadays, there's a live hashtag stream where people can comment on as people are talking on the stage and so on, which can be a little bit unnerving when you're talking on stage, I can tell you firsthand. But this was, you know, the idea of it being kind of a live discussion forum for a real-time event was not in their consciousness at all when they were creating this tool, and it turns out to be a really great use of the service. But it came entirely from the users, and so Twitter then said, well, listen, this is pretty cool. And so now hashtags are actually kind of officially recognized by the system, and you know, they've built tools to kind of enhance that and make it part of the actual formal kind of structure of Twitter. But it came entirely from the end users.
My guest today is Stephen Johnson. His latest book is titled The Innovator's Cookbook. It's an edited collection featuring a lot of great writers and thinkers on innovation, and it follows up on his previous book, Where Good Ideas Come From, which is just now out in softcover, and Innovator's Cookbook is a softback original from Penguin and Riverhead, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the interesting things is you actually sat down and featured some conversations. A wide variety of folks, Brian Eno, the composer and musician, Beth Novak, who's a proponent of open government, which is sort of the theme that sort of goes through a lot of these ideas of innovation, Microsoft's former chief software architect, Ray Ozzie. You've had educational experts talking about, for example, the change in educational reform from No Child Left Behind, which sort of mandated, to The Race to the Top, which is all about, okay, you come up with the best idea to educate. And so some really interesting conversations.
Yeah, that's really that was certainly my favorite part of the book to do. It was taking some folks whose work I just really admire and asking them, you know, not just about their work, but really about the process. I mean, my inspiration for that part was the old Paris Review series of Writers at Work, where they talked as much about the kind of the method of writers. And I was like, okay, here are these innovators in all these different fields. Like, how do they do it? You know, what are their techniques for having good ideas and for capturing them and putting them to practice? And so that was really a lot of fun.
Was there any common threads between these people who are working in very different fields?
Yeah, I think there were a number of them. You know, a big theme, and again, this was a big theme of Where Good Ideas Come From, is kind of getting yourself out of your customary routines and diversifying your kind of influences and the inputs into your life. And Brian Eno has this great thing that he does when he's done a million things in his career, but one of the things that he's most famous for is he's a record producer. He produces these albums for, he just produced one for Coldplay, and he's produced U2 and Talking Heads and so on. And so I was asking about how he gets the bands, when he gets these amazingly successful musicians into a studio, how does he get them to generate new ideas? And he has this great technique where he sits them down at the beginning of the process and he makes them play each other's instruments. So he's like, okay, drummer, you're now the lead guitarist. A keyboardist, you're rhythm guitar. Bassist, you're the vocalist. You know, and it turns out they can't really play each other's instruments very well. And so they start playing together, and they actually sound terrible. Yeah. But what happens is that there's something new that happens from that. They're technically not as good, but there's some new little spark of an idea that comes from them getting out of their kind of comfort zone. And because they, you know, the problem with these bands is they write their songs and then they play them 6,000 times and they just get stuck in a certain way of interacting and playing the kind of same old parts over and over again. And so by disorienting them, and that's a big theme, and Ray Ozzie talks in his discussion about his career, he always finds himself wanting to get disoriented, like going to a foreign city and walking around is just a great kind of trick for throwing your mind off its usual kind of grooves or tracks and you know, forcing yourself to come up with something new.
Well, it's a really interesting collection of essays. Follows up on Where Good Ideas Come From. Stephen Johnson, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Popular science writer Stephen Johnson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book is an edited volume titled The Innovative's Cookbook, Essentials for Inventing What Is Next. His most recent authored book, Where Good Ideas Come From, is now out in softcover. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're usually available online, almost always available online, at publicradiotulsa.org. Or you can subscribe to the Studio Tulsa podcast at the iTunes Store. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. For accommodation of disabilities, contact Dr. Jane Corso at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.